Well, thank you very much for coming out to this press conference. Dr. Kennedy Graham is releasing his members' bill today, and he can explain to you what it's about and why we're choosing today to do it. So, kia ora, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Materia, and my thanks to everybody for coming today in a rather quiet week. We are releasing my bill today, although it has been in the ballot twice and it hasn't yet been drawn, but with the luck of the Greens, we're totally confident it will emerge sooner or later. But independent of the ballot, it was important, we felt, to release the bill so that it could be open to public consideration and scrutiny, not least the fact that tonight at 5:30, the New Zealand Institute of International Affairs is convening one of its normal meetings, and the subject of that meeting, and I believe it's open to the public to come to at 5:30, the focus is on aggression in international law and in domestic New Zealand law. The speaker is Professor Roger Clark, who is a New Zealander who has had a distinguished career overseas and is temporarily back in New Zealand. He will be addressing that subject tonight, and I believe he will be addressing the bill itself. And on Friday, at the University of Canterbury in the School of Law, there will be a one-day colloquium on the subject, similar subject, and I'll be addressing my bill as one of the speakers in that colloquium. The Attorney General of New Zealand will be attending that. In fact, he'll be opening it and participating in the discussion throughout the day. So there is already a degree of professional scrutiny by the lawyers and the international relations experts on this starting from tonight, and I welcome that very much indeed. So let me first just convey to you the purpose of the bill. I know that there's a few pages of fairly dense material under the title of explanatory note for you to go through, and then there's the attached bill itself. The purpose of the bill, and if you need more time, please say so, and we can open that up for your own reading of it, but I'm assuming that you have gleaned enough of it now to explore it with me in this press conference. The purpose of the bill is twofold. There are two fundamental components to the bill. The first is to ensure that the use of force by our New Zealand troops overseas is always in conformity with the United Nations Charter. The second component of the bill, it's separate but obviously closely related, is that its political aim, in a very constructive way, is to protect our New Zealand leaders from external pressure to commit New Zealand troops overseas in situations that might be deemed to be illegal. So if we can get into place binding law in New Zealand that achieves those two objectives, we shall indeed be making progress. Those are the two purposes. What I thought I'd do is just very briefly recapitulate on the background in political and legal developments that have led up to where we are in 2009, and then scrutinize the content a little bit more for you, and then touch briefly on the political dimension of the bill before I open it up to questions and discussion. At the back of the room, there is an article I did a year ago, well, less, November last year, in the New Zealand International Review on this subject of making aggression a crime in domestic law. You're welcome to take copies. The short story, without going into great length, is that for millennia we've had what I call the free market of war, perfect competition. Anybody is free to leap on a horse and charge off madly in all directions at once. And the art of greatness was largely the art of conquering. And it is only in the last 100 years that the international community, after the better part of 5 millennia, has begun to even conceive that war should be constrained and ultimately rendered illegal, ultimately proscribed. The milestones are simply 1919 with the League of Nations Covenant, a rather unknown pact of 1928, where states, for the first time, renounced war as a national instrument of policy. But principally, of overriding importance, 1945, the United Nations Charter, which has ultimately proscribed war and set into place enforcement mechanisms of greater or lesser effect. That is the constitutional document governing the international community that you and I live under today, 1945, 63 years ago. That document made aggression illegal in international law. But that illegality pertained only to state responsibility. That is to say, if New Zealand or the United States or Iraq committed aggression under international law, under the UN Charter or against the UN Charter, it was a political act for which the state took responsibility. And it would be a political decision by the Security Council, which is a political body, to determine whether that aggression had occurred, and if so, to roll you back militarily. That, all of that is political, and it is state responsibility. None of that pertained in itself to any form of individual responsibility in criminal law. Roughly parallel with the movement to proscribe law, there has been an independent but related movement to make aggression a criminal liability. The slightly feeble attempt in 1920 under the Versailles Treaty to indict the Kaiser, the much more effective and potent Nuremberg and Tokyo tribunals after the Second World War, which were effective and largely, however, seen as victor's justice. But in the explanatory note, you will see a quote of Justice Robert Jackson of the United States, which essentially said, "Here we are sitting in judgment today, 1946-47. The same law will be applied to all of us in the future, including those of us who sit here today in judgment." Well, that's the 1940s. The General Assembly, i.e. the international community, then moved to try to make that permanent as opposed to a one-off tribunal in Nuremberg and Tokyo. And indeed, the international community made a lot of progress in the late 40s, early 50s, and actually had a draft code of criminal offences and a draft international criminal court. It was put on ice during the Cold War. It was brought out of the fridge and thawed in 1989 and ultimately took force in the International Criminal Court of 1998. That criminal court identifies three crimes and then a fourth, which is aggression. It is not in force yet, but it will be coming into force in the International Criminal Court shortly. None of that precludes a nation state moving on its own basis to make aggression a crime in domestic law, and that is what this bill is doing, parallel with and indeed in advance of the International Criminal Court. So much for the background. Let us look at the content of the bill. As I said, there are two principal components. One is that it establishes aggression as a crime in New Zealand law. Article 5 makes it unlawful for a New Zealand leader, and a New Zealand leader is defined, to plan, prepare, initiate, or execute an act of aggression, and if he or she does, then that becomes, quote, a crime of aggression. We can set aside any frivolous act of aggression by stating that it requires the character, gravity, and scale such as to be a manifest violation of the UN Charter. That would be, therefore, judicial interpretation. It defines aggression in Article 6, and that is based on the United Nations General Assembly definition in 1974, which is being further pursued in the International Criminal Court Special Working Group right now. And the further point is that it establishes an office, a new office, which is called the Office of the Special Prosecutor, which separates it out politically from otherwise the role of the Attorney General, who is, of course, part of his role as being in Cabinet itself. So you see the logic there. So that's the first principal component in the bill. The second is that it requires a New Zealand leader to have legal advice on the legality of deployment of any New Zealand forces before a decision is made to deploy them overseas. Article 9 says that you must seek, the leader must seek advice, except in cases of immediate self-defense against an armed attack, must seek legal advice on the legality of such deployment and lay it before Parliament at least 7 days before any such decision is made. It's important to make clear that once it is tabled, the role of members of Parliament is simply deliberative only. Parliament would not make the decision. The decision to deploy forces remains with the executive. But the legality of such a deployment would be open to debate and deliberation in the Parliament 7 days before an executive decision is made. Those are the two main dimensions of the bill, and we can explore them further if you wish. Just to conclude, a note on the political dimension of the bill. A number of comments. First, it's important to realize that the bill simply applies the same rules of international law today as has been the case for the last 63 years, since 1945. That is to say, an obligation not to commit aggression. There's no new constraint on the use of force by New Zealand under this bill. We still retain the right to engage in our armed forces in self-defense at our own initiative, and we still retain the right to deploy our armed forces overseas as part of any authorized United Nations military operation. That has been the case since 1945. It remains the case today in 2009 under this bill. Second point, we have judged it inadvisable to apply universal jurisdiction in this bill. That is to say, to presume that New Zealand can legislate to make aggression a crime on the part of any other leader outside New Zealand. President of the United States, President of China, President of Russia, anybody, Iraq, anybody. We're just talking about New Zealand. And that is because we are just New Zealand here ourselves. Universal jurisdiction is a very new and fragile concept and very complex, and it is enough to rest this bill on the much more robust and intact and clear-sighted obligation upon ourselves not to commit aggression. So those are the main points. I believe that in applying international law to New Zealand decision-making in this respect, we do protect our leaders from transgression, whether that transgression is innocent or otherwise. And we have an obligation. We have an obligation to protect our own boys overseas, the Wiliapiatas, the extraordinary men and women who display remarkable courage and commitment overseas on behalf of this country in our national interest. And an equally excruciating job on the part of our New Zealand leaders to make decisions as to when they're to be deployed overseas. It's not the easiest thing in the world. In fact, it's the hardest thing in the world. This is not an attempt to make life difficult for New Zealand leaders. This is an attempt to give them decent protection in law to make the existing international law come alive and mean something. I'm fairly keen to avoid, and I'm happy to discuss, the application of this bill to any specific case. But in doing so, it's really important to recognize that the motivation for this bill is not to charge at this New Zealand government or earlier New Zealand governments for any deployment of our people overseas. They've always been taken in good faith. This is for the future. This is to lay down standards for the future that we have not had in the past. It can obviously, in a hypothetical way, be applied to individual cases, including cases that are currently controversial and controversial in the past. And we can do it. But if we choose to do it, let us recognize that the main thrust of this bill is to render those kinds of decisions for those kinds of complex and difficult situations in the future easier, more lawful, and with a view to strengthening the global community of which we are a part. So thank you for listening to me, and I guess the floor is open to any comments or questions.
Can you say that the motivation isn't to criticise essentially anything that was done by an earlier or current government, You also said that it's to protect leaders from external pressure. Do you think that, is there a specific external pressure that you see as being there now or something that you're expecting in the near future?
Shall I answer this? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any crisis overseas requires statesman-like decisions by world leaders. Collective security is the concept that was brought in 1919. Therefore, by definition, it has to be the case that we all pitch in on these things. The leaders of the world, which are always the major military powers, will take the lead and then look to smaller powers to participate. The distinction is whether it is UN authorized or whether it is coalitions of the willing outside UN authorization. The line is pretty fine sometimes, but it's critical. We will be under pressure. We have been under pressure in the past. I mean, we can look at them. 1991, in recent times, okay? Well, let's just take since 45, which is what we're really talking about, our era. 1950, Korea, 1956, Suez, 1960s, Vietnam, 1991, Iraq, 2001, Afghanistan, 2003, Iraq. There are others. Those are the main ones.
Some of those have UN mandates. So
indeed, exactly.
I think I had the same question, really. Mm. Presuming that PIVS 2 isn't hypothetical, presumably you are thinking of particular occasions when New Zealand's leaders were subject to external pressure to join illegal action.
Every one of those.
Which ones were you thinking of?
Every one of those, we would have had external encouragement to be involved. 1950, we participated. That was UN authorized. 1956, we participated in Suez. It was not authorized and was condemned. We were in a minority 64-5, 1956. 1960s, Vietnam, very complicated. Certainly not authorized, but Cold War, and never really was subject to transparent UN exploration. 1991, UN authorized in Iraq. 2001, Afghanistan, the really complicated one that besets us today. Complicated, I'll come back to that. 2003, Iraq. Overwhelming juridical opinion that was outside the UN Charter, i.e. illegal. Back to Afghanistan, which is everybody's favourite subject for exploring this.
So in order to see which ones your bill would have applied to
right.
and been in force,
mm-hmm.
you're saying presumably Suez, you're yep. saying possibly Vietnam, Falklands?
All of these.
No, you're saying some of them are actually legal because they were UN sanctioned.
Yes, correct.
And you're saying The first Gulf War was UN sanctioned, the second one wasn't.
Correct.
So, but then some would argue that, as indeed the UK have argued, that the second Gulf War was actually UN sanctioned as well.
Yes, indeed. Lord Goldsmith's memo you can read. You read his memo 17, page one, 2 weeks beforehand, which said that it was illegal. Then you read his 1.5 page one of, I think, 17 March 2003 or thereabouts, which subsequently argued that it was legal.
Right.
The overwhelming majority of lawyers around the world, including the UN Secretary General, would respectfully take issue with Lord Goldsmith's second memorandum at the time and say that that was illegal, the invasion of Iraq.
So that's where I think when I look at 5.1,
right.
It actually begs the question because it actually assumes a manifest violation where most of the cases which come across the desk of New Zealand leaders are actually grey areas
yes.
where it's contested whether there is a UN mandate or there isn't one.
Yeah.
So given that it's a criminal offence to plan or prepare, how is a New Zealand leader to behave if they're actually entering a grey area where it may turn out to be illegal, but they're already committing a criminal offence if they're even planning something which may turn out to be legal?
By studying very closely the definition of aggression in the bill, because that would be then written into the criminal code, and it is exhaustive. And then getting legal advice from the Attorney General as to whether, in his opinion or her opinion, it is consistent with UN Charter and legal. They do this in a subliminal way for the last 50 years. What we're doing here in this bill is requiring that it be done in an explicit, reasoned, systematic, transparent way that is tabled in Parliament. The same decision-making goes on.
But I guess the point I'm getting at is that you're creating a criminal offence at a point when it's still unclear whether the act is or isn't criminal. Because preparation and planning is criminal under your bill, even though the action that it's relevant to is not yet decided to be criminal.
Well, this is taken from Nuremberg Tribunal, and the Nuremberg jurists and the people who laid down the principles of Nuremberg, which were then endorsed by the United Nations General Assembly, had no compunction in determining what was illegal and then saying planning it is illegal. Mm. It's a matter of judicial interpretation. And we have the same problem in domestic criminal law with murder, manslaughter, fraud, theft. You're always going to have these difficulties of definition and application, and for that matter, intent, mens rea, in domestic law. You're going to have it in international law. I agree with you, they are not easy issues to wrestle with, but we have no choice if we're to strengthen international law and to strengthen the fabric of global community to tackle them. If there is scope for tightening the definition or strengthening the judicial machinery for applying it, fine, let's do it, and I'll be interested in any comments, but let's not shy away from it because it's difficult.
A New Zealand leader is found to have become part of an act of aggression, what actually happens to them? Do you propose that you put them before the UN?
No. It's domestic court here. I mean, in due course, the International Criminal Court will introduce aggression as its fourth core crime.
Right.
When that happens, and when the 108 states parties, of which New Zealand is one, implements that into its own domestic law, which will happen, then it will be an option for New Zealand to either prosecute our own leader if he or she is alleged to have committed a crime in New Zealand courts or at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. But it is very clear with respect to the existing three core crimes, genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and then aggression in the future, that the domestic courts will be the courts of first instance. And you will only refer to The Hague if a decision is made in your own domestic judicial machinery that you will not proceed. That has happened with Uganda and CAR, Central African Republic, I think, already in the ICC. Sudan's a separate case.
What would the penalties be?
Up to 10 years imprisonment. Nuremberg and Tokyo had capital punishment and life. The main parallel overseas, there are better part of 25 or so countries that have imported this kind of crime into domestic law from customary international law, and there are another group of rather large group of 60 odd countries that in one way or another have broached the issue of aggression as a crime based on their own national values. So this is not a unique thing. Germany particularly, and copied by Paraguay, have made it a crime in their constitution. 10 years in their cases.
Would there be anything for sensitivity? I mean, a lot of the SAS, for example, the Prime Minister will often refuse to comment on what they're doing, where they're going, for sensitivity issues. If you're opening this up to a public debate in Parliament where anybody can listen, is there not some mechanism for?
There's two issues here. One is the act of deploying your troops overseas. The other is the conduct of your troops once they're deployed overseas. On the latter point, the conduct of the troops overseas, that has been the case for the last 9 years. I mean, our SAS are not in Afghanistan at the moment, but they have been in the past. Issues have arisen pertaining to detainees of prisoners and so on. That's one thing. But the decision to commit or recommit your troops overseas is an issue that personal political view now should, including with the SAS, should never in any way be, quote, secret. We are not a democracy if any government of this country deploys troops in secret overseas, allegedly in the name of strengthening international security, and refuses to tell New Zealand citizens about it. I have the greatest respect for the SAS people and their family, and the greatest concern for their families. It does not follow that they have the right to total privacy because they have been deployed as SAS troops. That does not hold. So therefore, it would become mandatory that the deployment, and it does say, of any troops overseas, and that includes the SAS, would have to be tabled before Parliament to ensure the legality of the deployment itself. What they then do overseas is a separate issue, and we can all have our own ideas about that as well.
But under 10.3, where a New Zealand citizen can bring a to the attention of the special prosecutor their concerns about an alleged crime of aggression, does that have any kind of injunctive power? Like, until the person complaining to the or bringing to the attention of the special prosecutor gets a reply, can there be any kind of injunction brought in the meantime until the ruling has been made?
Yeah, fair question. Personal view, no.
Right, because it says possible contravention, so it's still, you know...
Yes, but that could also be retroactive as well.
Right. Because the person could feel like it was a bit of a dead letter by the time that the prosecutor decided and the troops are already on the ground.
Well, I know there were various attempts in 2003 in the UK before the troops were committed to that end. And they failed, of course, and also Rex V. Jones after the invasion failed as well.
Right.
But it's a fair issue. And I think my personal view is that it should be sufficient for the tabling in Parliament, 7 days of deliberation, executive decision.
Right.
You say this bill's been in the ballot twice. When did you first introduce it?
First ballot, which was maybe a month ago. It's a labour of love.
Given that sort of one person's act of aggression can be another person's self-defence, and given that, like in the last few days, we've seen Vice President Biden saying that defining an Israeli attack upon Iran as being a legitimate sovereign right of self-defence, do you feel that there may well be a bit of a definitional problem here for any New Zealand court trying to make a ruling as to whether an act was a preemptive act was aggression or self-defence?
Yes. I agree with you and your questions that the matter is complex. But as I said earlier, it is in full recognition of that complexity that we have to simply resolve with determination to proceed to make sure that the definitional dimension of a crime is tight enough and exhaustive enough to stand the scrutiny of judicial machinery. And that if a leader, I mean, you can have armies of lawyers arguing the toss, and you do, including in murder trials, as we have seen quite recently. That's why you have judges. We have judges to finally settle the matter, for better or worse. We're all human, we're all fallible. But we use force, and therefore we have to make sure that it's lawful. So we've got to do it.
I guess what I'm getting at is that when international law itself is pretty opaque about these issues, you're creating a framework for a criminal offence.
Correct.
When the means of adjudicating it don't exist.
International law on this subject is less opaque than most people think. The weakness is the enforcement. The law is there. If you read international law pertaining to the use of force overseas, you will find that it actually is, personal view, about as robust as the law pertaining to murder and manslaughter in domestic crimes. You can try to drive a wagon through some of the barn doors in domestic law in this respect. Yes, international law is weaker, and we are making painstaking progress on it. But we, personal view, we are at the point where we can proceed to do this kind of thing. And I'm telling you that within 5 to 10 years in the International Criminal Court, They are tackling this. The Special Working Group on the Crime of Aggression are tackling these issues right now and making distinct progress. The law has been there for 63 years. It is a quantum step forward to bring it into a domestic crime. I totally agree. But I firmly believe that the letter of the law is sufficiently robust and the politics of our time are sufficient for us to proceed now. Yeah.
Do you see New Zealand eventually moving from a dualist approach in international law to a monist?
Objective answer, no. Subjective answer, it would probably be a good idea if we did. Because then there's less... It's tempting to look at countries like Italy and Germany and Spain and so on, Netherlands, I think, and say this is to do with the automatic implementation of customary international law into your domestic code. Just automatic implementation, and it overrides domestic law, so your domestic law by definition has to be consistent, as opposed to the dualist approach, which is the British-derived New Zealand approach, where you need the two branches of law are entirely separate, and it is a conscious act by your government and your parliament to translate your international law obligations that you may have signed into your binding domestic law. If you do the latter, and ultimately when you do the latter, it is clearer, but it is much easier not to do it because of the dualist tradition. So this bill would be creating new ground in one respect, borrowing from the monist tradition to set up a special office of the prosecutor based on the German situation, and for that matter, our own serious fraud office. So we actually have done it before.
You know, just mindful you talk about going forwards.
Yeah.
But I have to give a hypothetical. Is if, say, events in Fiji degenerated to the point where they might be perceived by New Zealand leaders
right.
as a necessity to enter Fijian territory in order to protect New Zealand citizens,
yes.
That may be interpreted internationally as being an act of aggression. Would you regard that hypothetical as requiring the 7 days' notice in the New Zealand Parliament before any action?
New Zealand troops going into Fiji?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Any deployment of New Zealand troops overseas, especially if resort to armed forces is going to occur, has to be done. In that situation, what you would have to do, if I were a New Zealand leader, obtaining Attorney General legal advice to put before Parliament, and the Attorney General, now I am reasoning on my personal basis, the Attorney General would say, any deployment by New Zealand troops overseas, either independently or in collaboration with Australia, would require in the first instance a decision by the Pacific Island Forum under Article 53 of the UN Charter. But that in itself would not be sufficient, because regional organizations under Article 53 cannot take a decision to deploy armed force without the prior, and that the word is not there in the Charter but is understood, prior authorization of the UN Security Council. If you don't have that, don't go.
See, some would say in the interim, the New Zealand citizens may well be in harm's way.
So, to that extent,
some would argue that this bill would actually restrict the capacity of the New Zealand government to protect its citizens.
Yeah. The normal doctrine of self-defense under Article 51 of the Charter allows for brief military operation to protect your nationals. And then it becomes a matter of judgment and ultimately, in this case, judicial interpretation as to whether that extends to how long, how far into a country, what they do when they're there, and whether they stay. And we can think of 1982 Grenada as the best example. 1982, 83 Grenada, best example. But there are many others. Sierra Leone, 1997. In fact, history is littered with cases of self-defense in the name of protection of nationals. But it is an established doctrinal right. Tough times.
Yeah.
As you mentioned before, aggression is becoming a preparatory norm according to the ICSA.
Yeah.
Why don't you let them deal with it?
You can. You could. It's just that life goes on, and we can wait for Godot. And you could wait for
a more appropriate form.
It is possible to do that. There's nothing to stop us moving as a nation. In fact, I think you could argue that we make a more added value contribution to the strengthening of law if we proceed ourselves in 2009-10 and contribute at the same time to the reasoning process in the ICC. It could take anything from 2 to 20 years. In the ICC. Other countries have already moved, Germany and others.
I'm not too familiar with the requirement for something becoming like just commons or provisional law. Is it through like an amendment to the Rome Statute?
No. Well, usually something becomes jus cogens if it is laid down by consensus in a UN declaration or in a convention. And it is not violated, so state practice over a period of years makes it clear that states endorse it, and it is of such a fundamental character to humanity that it is generally recognized by jurists and so on. But that has happened with aggression, actually, since 1946.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.